We're going to be talking about the future tonight, and what we're talking, the title we've given this, it's changed several times, is Shifting Christian Lifestyle into the Future Tense, and it's good to be at Holden at last. Like I told the teaching session, I've been on my way to Holden for over 10 years, and it just takes some of us a longer time to get here. I don't know why I haven't come before, but it's something that I've wanted to do because what's happening at Holden is really unique in the country. There are very few groups of people that come together around the kinds of issues and concerns, from spirituality to the concerns for the environment and creation, that are so much a part of Holden, lifestyle issues. So I'm glad to finally be here. I have not come before. It feels very much like coming home. And I come as a learner, and I'm here to learn from the rest of you, and we're going to have interaction in these sessions. I come as one very concerned about mission. And I guess I have to just kind of alert you that I'm going to be pushing pretty hard on some things tonight and from a little different point of view, so that I hope that provokes some good discussion. And I come as an author, and I'm struggling on a book now called Wild Hope, and much of what I'm going to be sharing tonight comes out of that. I'd like to ask you, what have you come for, both to Holden and this particular session? If you could give me some sense of, you know, why you came, then see if what I prepared is anything like what you came for. What expectations? Why are you here? This session. You could, it's a lovely evening out. You could, you know, be in working with the dish crew or having that 6 piece of pizza. Why are you in here? Okay, just
I'm just here for the program.
Okay, here for the program.
Whatever happens. Expecting God.
Okay. And open to what God does. Okay. Others of you, expectations? One at a time, please.
I wasn't aware this was going on, but I come to Holden for a renewal. It's just a place that I can find myself, and I don't have to worry about anything going on around me. I have no schedules to meet, and I find a real renewal.
I'm looking forward to that, too. I have not been here, and I can already sense that this is a wonderful place to come for that. Others, why are you here? Why this session particularly? Why did you turn out to this session? Oh, you're just taking your hat off. don't reach for your hat unless you're serious.
I'm looking at the potential of retiring from teaching in 6 years, and so this sounded like you were forward-looking and might help.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the future, and we wanted to engage you in personal terms. How many of those of you who are single are in transition or are struggling with major decisions? Okay, we're going to be talking to people about making good decisions in terms of a changing future. So we're going to try to get into that. My, they keep coming. We've got room over on the blue table. And there's some chairs over here. Come on in, one and all. Yeah, there's some chairs right over here that we saved for you guys. Last chance. What else brings you out tonight? Last chance. Anyone else? Yes. Oh.
I was waving to my husband.
Oh, okay. Well, okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. Once in a while, they wave to me, too.
That's even better.
Yeah. Well, in talking about shifting... And talking about shifting Christian lifestyle into the future tense, I want to look back at the last lifestyle movement for just a minute. There haven't been many books written on Christian lifestyle since Ron Sider's Rich Christians in the Age of Hunger, Richard Foster's Discipline of Simplicity, Finnerty's No More Plastic Jesus, Enough is Enough by Taylor. How many of you have read some of those books? How many have read Rich Christians? Okay. How many have read Finnerty's No More Plastic Jesus, Catholic book on lifestyle change? Discipline of Simplicity by Foster? Doris Longacre's Living More for Less? Okay. Well, the last lifestyle movement, and it's really come and gone. It was part of it was the end of the 70s, and really didn't, it wasn't a part of the landscape in the 80s. High indulgence kind of took over. And we were told the magic of the marketplace would solve all our problems, not to worry. So we moved away, and I think the last lifestyle movement tended to see lifestyle change primarily in economic terms. and in terms of kind of scaling down, downward economic mobility, I don't think it was really easy to market. I think people lost interest in it real fast. I think we're in the threshold of a new lifestyle movement. And I'm going to talk more about that in more detail Monday night. But I think we're on the threshold of a lifestyle movement that sees the change not primarily in economic terms, but in terms of cultural transformation. Instead of trying to do the American dream with a little Jesus overlay, like it all fits together, I think we're going to see people understanding that to follow Christ, we are going to have to do a much more serious critique of culture and invite God to transform the values of materialism and individualism and self-seeking so that we can be a part of a whole new movement. And I think it's going to be a movement with much more celebration, but also where we learn to do things more simply, we will discover we don't need as much. I think there's the possibility, and I think I see it in the wings. People at threshold time, and from the raising of hands, many of you are at threshold time. These are important years of decision. And a recent study taken by Gallup shows that people who are thinking about the future in the 90s are thinking about the future in personal terms very optimistically. The optimistic scale is rising. But they see the larger future in rather pessimistic and dire terms. And they don't seem to realize that those two connect. There's not a recognition that they go together, okay? So what I want to do tonight for people at threshold time is to help us think, those of us that are struggling with life decisions and those of us just moving into a new decade, I want to try to expand the range of opportunities and challenges. I want us to try to see the future, not in terms of being overwhelmed, and some of the material that I'm going to present tonight could be overwhelming, but to see the emerging challenges for people at life decision time and threshold time as emerging opportunities. We are at the threshold of the last decade of the 20th century. We're at the threshold of a whole new century, and we're at the threshold of the third millennium since the coming of Christ. Only once before has the church gone through a major millennial shift, and it was in the year 1000. And that period immediately before that was a time of tremendous turbulence. And I think we're starting to see the change and dramatic turbulence stirring again. We've seen tremendous change in the last 3 months. We've seen images of dancing on the West Berlin Wall. We've seen children singing in the streets of Soweto at the release of Nelson Mandela. We've seen young people flooding into churches in Hungary to pray. And what I'm trying to affirm in my book, and I want to start off by affirming tonight, that the dance on the Berlin Wall is the dance of God. And the kids singing in the streets of Soweto are the songs of God. And the prayers in the churches of Hungary are the prayers of God. That God is alive and well and at work in all. And in the crucifixion of what's happening in El Salvador. But in the joy and celebration. And somehow, what I hope more Monday night than tonight, we can start getting connected with the hope of that. And so Monday night, we're going to talk about something of the hope of God. And let me just go down the list. The focus, tonight we're going to try talking about anticipating new challenges. And then Monday night, we're going to talk about discerning God's purposes. For those at the life decision times in transition, we need to be much clearer as to what God is up to in history so that we can link our lives much more intentionally to that, and then to be much more in touch with the creative new ways that we can express that. And I find people who are making major decisions tend to limit themselves to a narrow range of options, whether it's leaving education or a number of other things. We're going to try to expand that. And for singles, those of us who are single, those who are married, we're going to try to expand your range of options for you and help you see that there's a much broader range of possibilities than we may have realized. Get us started with a little story, Life with Brian. I had one of the most unusual days of my entire life a few years ago when I was in London. Publisher offered to take me on a tour of downtown London. Well, I love London. Never turn down a tour if you get a chance. And they sent this young man by the name of Brian to take me on this tour. This has to be one of the most unusual days of my entire life because of who Brian was. And to explain who Brian was, I have to ask you, how many of you saw that film a few years ago, The Gods Must Be Crazy? Do you remember the biologist in the film that became an absolute disaster zone anytime he was around women? That was my friend Brian. The only difference was Brian didn't need women. He could do it all by himself. Sat down in this expensive downtown restaurant in London. Brian sat down across from me, crossed his legs, went screaming under the table. Somehow, in the simple act of crossing his legs, he virtually shattered his kneecap. We got him out from underneath the table. 15 minutes later, we're leaving the hotel. I hear screams behind me. I look behind me. Here's Brian with his finger caught in the top of the revolving door going around and around and around. I don't know what he was doing with his hand on the top of the revolving door. I'm not exaggerating. Every 15 minutes, a new disaster happened to Brian. I kept saying, what's happening? Are we on candid camera? What is happening? Unbelievable. So I developed this theory of self-victimization, that some of us just have a need to destroy ourselves. And Brian is one of the unfortunate in that group, only to have my theory destroyed when we went out on a beautiful blue sky day like here in Holden today to eat outdoors on Carnaby Street. It took Brian forever to get his baked potato. Gets his baked potato, brings it to the table, cuts open the foil, takes a bite. It's ice cold. Doesn't care. The guy's famished. He hasn't had breakfast. As he's on approach with his fork for bite number two, out of nowhere, Seagull comes and hits the baked potato dead center. And Brian just folds his napkin over like this happens every day. And for Brian, this very well may happen every day. We don't know. By this time, I'm praying for this poor chap. Dear Lord, spare this young man. We get on the subway, the underground at the end of the day, and I said, thank God we're on the subway. Nothing can happen now. Brian sits down. On this side of him, a metal panel, 6 inches away, is a very large guy. Looks like a coal miner. Empty seats all over the subway, okay? I'm sitting across from him, empty seats everywhere. This very large woman gets on. I'm guessing over 500 pounds, very large woman. She's not interested in any open seats. She wants the 6 inches next to Brian. And she brings it on her back. Brian goes into the metal panel, shoulder in his ear, and he sits in contorted pain for 45 minutes. Gets off the subway, and he says, Tom, he says, you may not believe this, but he says, last week, he says, I was actually hit by an ambulance. I said, Brian, I have no trouble believing that at all. Now, many of us, it's true. Many of us spend a lot more time on the front end of ambulances and in garbage compactors than we need to because we do not take the future seriously. In the church, we don't take the future seriously. We tend to live our lives and plan our organizations like the future is going to be more of the same. Before we go forward into the 90s and beyond, I want to go backwards. 60s, 70s, and 80s. Help me out a minute. What were some of the unexpected happenings the last three decades, 60s, 70s, and 80s? Some of the surprises. Help me.
Assassination.
The assassinations of Dr. King and the Kennedy brothers?
Vietnam.
Vietnam?
Watergate.
Watergate? Anybody over here? Remember any of those? You're too young. You don't remember 60s, 70s?
The inflation started.
The inflation? What else? Come on.
The civil rights.
The civil rights? In Vatican II, in the women's movement, come on. The hippie movement, the counterculture, the drug scene, the Jesus people, the environmental crisis. Rachel Carson's book was the beginning of that whole awareness. What else?
America started to unravel.
America started to unravel. What over here?
Arms for hostages.
Nuclear freeze.
Campus unrest.
Student protest. Kent State. Jackson State. Landing on the moon.
Test tube babies,
the sexual revolution. Remember we discovered poor people in America? We didn't know there were poor people there, and Harrington told us that 20% of the American people were poor, and the civil rights movement we've talked about, and the list could go on. Question number two.
AIDS.
Yeah. Sure. There are many other things we've left off, but question number two, how effectively did the church respond to the happenings 60s, 70s, and 80s?
Not very.
And the reason... One of the reasons we didn't do very well is that we really didn't expect the future to be different. We really didn't. Eisenhower was in the White House in 1959, and the big international news was somebody going over that infamous Berlin Wall. All of a sudden, we hit the vortex of change called the 60s, and every time we turned around, there was change. And we didn't plan for the world to be different. And so what happened, the church got caught in a reactive instead of a proactive mode. We were surprised over and over and over again by change. We didn't prepare our young people in our Christian colleges and seminaries. We prepared them to live in the world that is instead of the world that's going to be. We didn't help them get in touch with the new values issues. We didn't help them get in touch with the new ethical issues, the civil rights, the women's movement. So as a consequence, instead of providing leadership, the church got caught in a reactive mode. Well, let me kind of draw the line under this and emphasize it a bit. Alvin Toffler, who wrote Future Shock and Third Wave, if some of you read those books, predicts we will experience as much change in the next 10 years, as the past three decades, that the rate of change is escalating dramatically. Therefore, if we're going to be the people of God, sisters and brothers together doing the work of God, it is essential that we take the future seriously. And yet I have to tell you, in working with mainline denominations, Lutheran, Maranatha Fathers and Brothers and Sisters, working with the American Baptist Church, the church does not take the future seriously. We plan as though the future is going to be more of the present. We plan our lives as though things aren't changing. And we miss tremendous range of opportunities as we did in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Therefore, if we're going to be responsible as we move into a new century, it's essential that we start paying attention. Of course, people are starting to wake up the environmental issue, but many of the things we're talking about now, it's a Rip Van Winkle experience for some of us. We were talking about global warming and everything back in 74. This is not new information, okay? So it's time for us to get in touch with the new challenges and ask, what are the implications for our lives and for our larger mission responsibility in the world? And as I come down at the end of this list, I'm going to be very direct in assessing my best guess at how well the church is going to do in responding to some of these. I'm going to sketch. I don't have time to go over everything. I'm not going to hit all of the points, but I'm going to hit a few high points of some of the changes. For some of you in the life decision years, these may be opportunities. For all of us, there certainly be challenges as we work and serve in the church in the 90s and beyond. I'm going to look at some global challenges, some national challenges, and then I'm going to ask what the capability of the church is to respond to these. Biosphere 2. We are at the threshold, not only the last decade of the 20th century and a new millennium, we are at the threshold of the development of the high frontier. And it's going to mean more than Corningware and Teflon pans this time around. It's going to mean the colonization of space. Outside of Tucson, Arizona, Biosphere 2 sits. It's the first space community that is where eight astronauts, men and women, are living in completely secluded environment under a plexiglass dome covering 2.25 acres for 2 years. They have a savanna, they have a rainforest, they have a desert, they have 20,000 square feet of agricultural space. They are raising and butchering their own animals, and they will not come out of this environment for the next 2 years. If this succeeds, the goal is to put this prototype on the moon by 2005 and Mars by 2030. I've been hollering to peace and justice people since 1974 that we need to call for a moratorium of taking the arms race into space, because we were so focused on the immediate issues of the arms race, we didn't anticipate where military research was taking us with the whole Star Wars issue. Christians need to be involved in the ethical developments of the high frontier, and I don't know of anyone in the ecumenical community, the evangelical church, that's paying attention to that, or to the tremendous possibilities that the eye in the sky represents. The satellites that are used for spy activity have tremendous possibility for Earth stewardship. A friend that's going to be working with me in a program I've started called the Creative Future Center is a geophysicist who wants to start something called Menosat and use satellite sensing, remote sensing, to be involved in third world rural development activities, agricultural development. Can tell you where your corn is blighted in Kenya. Could tell you where resources are likely to be located. So we need to start getting in touch with both the new challenges, the new technologies, and ask, as people who are going to be living in a very different world, what our responsibility is in the stewardship not only of the Earth, but of the high frontier. And welcome to Earth Decade. I don't have anything to say here that you haven't already heard. This is a group that's very much aware that we only have 10 to 15 years to start turning this one around. We can't monkey around with the environment any longer. You know about the heat trap effect. I think that's a better term for it than the greenhouse effect. You know about the ozone layer. You may not know that we're also polluting the oceans. The inlets in which life is formed and rebirthed and recreated are being polluted by heavy metals and other toxins that jeopardize the reproductive capability of the whole ocean. And by and large, the church is not really coming to grips with this. The leadership is starting to speak out, particularly in the ecumenical side. On the evangelical side of the church, nothing is being said. So we are in a tremendous decade. I think this is going to be Earth Decade, and we have opportunity to provide leadership. In the political realm, we're moving from a bipolar world where the American-Soviet conversations have dominated for decades to a multipolar world where by the year 2000 there will probably be five superpowers. The United States and the Soviet Union, of course, but Japan, a reunified Germany, European Community 92, China and India are also aspirants to be a part of that new superpower community. That's going to fundamentally change the power balance. It means that the United States is no longer going to be able to work as unilaterally as we've seen in Panama and other places. We're going to have to start learning to work multilaterally. It'll mean a diminishment of U.S. power, because as soon as you get more players in those ranks, it changes the whole configuration of power. And we need to start anticipating, in terms of our political concerns, how that needs to change our advocacy. And just going along with that for a minute, I want to point out tremendous opportunities for global peacemaking, not just between the Soviet Union and the United States, but we have unprecedented opportunities in other parts of the world. There's real serious negotiation going on between India and Pakistan. I think the changing climate has made possible North and South Korea. I think that even in Latin America, in Central America, there's some possibilities of some new rapprochement. The Middle East, we only have, I think, about 5 to 7 years because of the tremendous polarization demographically in that region. That region can be we can see a Lebanization of Israel in the next few years if something isn't done to bring the parties together. And it sounds like the Bush administration is backing off from that. But we need to be in the forefront of identifying and anticipating where the new opportunities are for peacemaking and be a part of that. We're in a global economic race that's changing the character of the world, too. We're going to see a regionalization from all that I'm reading of global economies. Three major regions: Asia, Europe, and the Americas. Asia is growing at the fastest rate, and they're going to be in the forefront of the race. They're growing from 5 to 7 to 10% annual economic growth. And we are starting to feel, somebody said the Cold War is over and Japan has won. In a very real sense, that's true. And what we've done with the end of the Cold War is that the religious and political right have lost their enemy. There's no more evil empire to kick around. And it looks like the new enemy may well be Japan. And we'll see economic competition where there's been political competition before. And so they're going to be at the forefront. If the European community, have you guys heard about the European community coming together, 12 nations developing a new economic, and it looks like a new political confederation too. They're projected to grow at 4 to 6% a year. Do you know how much our economic growth is in the United States right now? Yeah, it's just over 2%. And the fact is that we're going to be in the end of that race. The prosperity of the last 8 years the prosperity was not out of our productivity, it was out of our indebtedness. You've seen the bumper sticker, we're living off our kids' inheritance, that's what we've been doing. Mr. Bush was right, it really was voodoo economics. And the problem is that we cannot continue the kinds of affluence that we've enjoyed over these past years by continually borrowing from the future. My best sense is, whether you're concerned about lifestyle change or not, all of us are going to be looking, particularly those that are younger, at some fairly significant lifestyle downscaling in the next few years, because in this three-way race, we're not doing very well. But I want to talk about the future of the poor, because in some ways, they're not even a part of this race. While Asia is going to see a tremendous blossom of a new middle class, there are a tremendous number of poor in Asia, 180 million landless people, okay, in Asia. And so we're going to see a growing polarization between rich and poor. There are countries like Nepal and Bangladesh that could environmentally collapse in within this decade. That's a very real possibility. While other parts of Asia are lifting off, so we're going to see growing polarization. Latin America has lost 10 years to the debt crisis. 10 years to the debt crisis, and there's every indication that they're going to lose another decade. And that means that they will have less money to help to spend to care for their own poor people. Africa is the continent at greatest risk. And I was talking to Jane on the way up in the car. She's seen it firsthand. I haven't. But Africa is a continent in which many of the nations there and some other parts of the world, their population growth is in excess of 3% a year. Their economic and food production is minus to no more than 2% a year. Now, what will happen over time if you're running over 3% population growth and if your economic and food production growth is going the other direction? What's going to happen? We're going to see increasing famine. We're going to see tremendous pressure on food resources. The AIDS epidemic is much more severe than we've been hearing, and we're going to see millions of children orphaned in Africa. Our Christian organizations are not mobilizing to address the tremendous new challenges that we're going to see in the third world. Let me give you the stats. Well, we're meeting here tonight. We share the planet with 5.2 billion people. By the year 2000, it'll jump to 6.2 billion people, and it won't be long until we reach the 10 million figure, about 2030. The problem is that we cannot sustain that level of growth. There are some 1 billion people live in a condition called absolute poverty tonight. That's absolute poverty means making less than $90 per person per year $90 per person per year, and half the kids in that population do not survive to age 5. Every indication is that that population is going to grow, the gap is going to widen, and our Christian organizations, again, because we're not anticipating, we're just trying to address the needs that are evident today, are not going to be there. And people who are single, people who are looking for new possibilities, a tremendous range of career opportunities. And agriculture, cottage industry, small business, we need to do some whole new areas. In my first book, The Mustard Seed Conspiracy, I mentioned that the party is over. And I believe that. By that, I simply was trying to say that the great consumer society that we have come to take for granted is over. Many of the people will not even survive unless we within the church fundamentally re-examine our theology of earthkeeping and stewardship. And here's where I want to push a little bit. Ecumenical people, you talk more about peace, justice, and integrity of the environment, say more about the poor than any other part of the church, but you give less. 2.8% is the average giving throughout the church generally, but generally with most ecumenical churches I work with, it's often 1% to 2%.
How can you define those terms, ecumenical
mainline,
evangelical?
Okay. Mainline churches, ecumenical churches are your churches that are historic denominations, United Methodist, United Church of Christ, Roman Catholic, Lutheran. Your Missouri Synod would probably be seen more as an evangelical group along with Nazarene, Assembly of God, some of your private churches. So because you draw from both groups, I'm trying to talk to both groups. You have people here out of both backgrounds, I think. Okay? So it's a concern, and here's where I want to push a little bit in terms of all of us, whether we're at threshold time or not in terms of stewardship, is that what we've been operating with in most of our churches is we give up the 10%. The standard teaching is the tithe view of stewardship. And then essentially what we do with the rest of our time or our money is kind of up to us. Well, a growing number of New Testament scholars, people like John Howard Yoder, are saying that there's nothing in the Scripture, there's nothing in the New Testament about a tithe view of stewardship. Understanding the Old Testament origins, what seems to be discussed and presented in very full, complete terms in the New Testament is a whole life, or what they call jubilary stewardship. Okay? Whole life stewardship or jubilary stewardship is premised on the scripture, the earth is the Lord's. If the earth is indeed the Lord's, then it's no longer a question of how much of mine do I have to relinquish. If the earth is the Lord's, the question becomes how much of God's do I get to keep? In a world in which other people can't keep their kids fed, even other Christians are not even able to keep their kids fed. So we need to fundamentally re-examine, because what we've done in the church is just kind of embrace the American dream as a foregone conclusion and all the demands it makes on our time and resources, and then out of our leftovers of time and resource, we give to the church. And we're simply not going to be able to begin to respond to the challenges of the next century with those kind of giving patterns. So we need to re-examine that, not out of guilt, but out of opportunity. Now, many people not realizing the party is over. Do you know where they're going geographically, trying to get a piece of the action and participate in the great consumer society? Where are they going? Cities. Unprecedented urban explosion. Nothing like it in the history of the world, ever. How many of you have ever been to Latin America? Okay, if you go back in Latin America in the year 2000, you'll find 75% of the people living in cities by the year 2000. Mexico City, numero uno, 32 million people all in one city. Sao Paulo, Brazil, second, 25 million. Calcutta, Bombay, 19 million apiece. Now, if you've ever walked the streets of Calcutta, there's no more place for people. There are 1 million people, families, 1 million people that live on the streets, sleep on the streets, never live under a roof today. And the reason it says apocalypse up there is these cities cannot sustain this level of growth. And unless our denominational institutions and our Christian Relief and Development Agency start mobilizing now, in 10 to 15 years, we're going to see it on our colored television, we're going to see total breakdown of cities, urban collapse. Lima is on the threshold of that today. And yet I don't find any of our denominations starting to mobilize. In fact, mainline denominations, as we'll talk about in a little while, are cutting back in terms of overseas mission giving. So people, threshold time, we need some urban agriculture. We need people starting small businesses, working in partnership with sisters and brothers. We're also doing something that's very interesting that we aren't, it's kind of below the level of consciousness. Technologically, we are fusing ourselves on a gigantic electronic nervous system that girdles the whole globe. For better or for worse, get out of this network of fax machines and satellite dishes, and we are, you know, and it has tremendous capability. Part of the revolution in Romania came from television. But it also means we are living in a society with no exit. the surveillance capabilities, and I don't think that we in the church have been nearly critical enough of the place of technology in society. As a Christian movement, we're going backwards, not forwards in the world. There will be fewer Christians in the world percentage-wise by the year 2000 than today. We're a diminishing movement, and that doesn't have much visibility. How many of you are thinking maybe of short-term missions at some point in the future, going overseas? Well, you need to know the church is changing dramatically, too. By the year 2000, over half of all the Christians in the world will be in the Southern Hemisphere, and that's true in many denominations today. They'll be younger, they'll be poorer, they'll be probably more than a little upset with the way the rest of us have been using up the planet. We're 5% of the world's people using about 40% of the world's resources. What this means is we're seeing a shift in the leadership of the church. Increasingly, the leadership is going to come from the Southern Hemisphere. The renewal of the church is going to come from the Southern Hemisphere. We're going to see reverse missions, and God knows we need the reverse missions coming and revitalizing our churches here. And it'll mean that we're going to have to come down off our Western arrogance, and we can no longer consider ourselves biblically literate simply reading European and American theologians. We'll need to listen to what sisters and brothers are saying from Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And so we need to get in touch with the fact that God is starting to lead from another direction in the church. Now, not only are we moving into a future that's increasingly international, cross-cultural, we're moving into the Browning of America. America is changing very rapidly. At the turn of the last century, 13% of the people were described as non-white. They didn't have it broken down into compartments. By the year 2000, one child in three in our elementary schools will be from minority background. And by 2056, if you're from European ancestry and still alive in the United States by then, you will be minority. If you live, how many of you are Californians? Californians, you go back to California in the year 2000, you're still white, you're minority. We are seeing the Browning of America. I said in an article in Christianity Today that the culturally disadvantaged of the 90s are going to be the middle-class white young people raised in the suburbs of America that have had no cross-cultural experience and only speak one language and don't speak it that well. We are doing our kids a disservice. We are cheating our kids, and we're not preparing them to live in tomorrow's world. I work a lot in Europe, and I work with young people there that have had all kinds of cross-cultural experiences, speak 3 to 5 languages fluently. And there's no way that the young people in our home are going to be able to compete in the marketplace or begin to provide the leadership in the church in the ways that young people in other parts of the world will, because we have raised them in environments that we haven't thought about. And with the Browning of America, tremendous opportunities for us to receive the gifts that we have to give from our African American, Hispanic, Asian backgrounds. But there is greater animosity and racism in the United States today than any time during my lifetime that I can remember. And the church is silent. I am hearing virtually nothing from the church speaking out about the racism on our campuses, in our society. And somehow we need to create celebrations in our cities where we bring together people from all different kinds of ethnic backgrounds and celebrate the oneness that we have as the people of God. Somehow we need to celebrate the gifts that we have to bring. But not only are we going to see the Browning of America, we're going to see the graying of America. All of those of you who are baby boomers, don't be embarrassed by it. Raise your hands. Boomers everywhere. 46 to 64. Born 46 to 64. Raise your hands. Okay. All, see, we've got a room that's heavy full of boomers. You, born. I do a chalkboard version of this that's a little slower and later in the evening. Those born from 46 to 64, raise your hands. There we go. Okay. You guys are a problem. You've been described by the demographers in very glorious terms as a pig passing through a python. Can you kind of get behind that imagery? Because there are 77 million of you, the largest population ever, because after World War II, people came back and they thought, you know, this is what we're supposed to be about. So they had all these kids. The problem that we're facing, and it's a very serious problem, we're laughing, but the ecumenical church is going to be there ahead of anyone else, is the graying of America. We don't begin to have nursing homes, medical facilities to begin to pay for the cost of your generation. And many of you chose not to get married, not to have kids. You don't have caregivers coming along. So we're going to be facing a crisis, and it's going to be happening in the ecumenical churches before the larger society, because your median age is much, much further along. And so resources that we would have used to address some of those international problems or domestic problems are going to be invested in caregiving. And we're going to see women who are going to be giving care to both their mothers and their grandmothers. We're going to have 4 generational situations. And for women particularly who wind up being the caregivers, it's going to be a tremendous responsibility. So we need to start thinking about that and the implications for our lives and for the church. And we're facing an older, younger polarization. We're not only going to see a widening gap between rich and poor in the United States continue, which it certainly did during the Reagan years. There was a major redistribution of income. The rich are richer, the poor are poor. But the senior citizens are no longer the poor in our midst. During the war on poverty days, any number of seniors were very, very poor. But today, there are very few poor seniors except in some minority populations. In fact, the wealthiest segment of the population today are the people over 50. The retired people are the ones that are buying the Love Boat cruises. They're loaded. They're absolutely loaded. The new poor of the 90s are children. Tens of thousands of children in the homeless shelters of America. One child in four in the United States is born into poverty. It's gone up dramatically, one in four. So we're facing a crisis. The seniors are organized politically through AARP and Grey Panthers, and they know how to swing their muscle and get their way with Congress. The kids aren't organized, they can't vote, and they don't have a lobby. We need a renaissance of concern, compassion, and working with the children, and not just building more downtown shelters. I get so tired of ecumenical people just building shelters downtown. We need to start sponsoring families, single moms and their kids out in the suburbs. Remember when we did that with refugees? Instead of paying somebody to do it downtown where we don't have to be involved hands-on, we need to invite them out there, help them find housing, jobs, childcare, and reestablish their lives. Because 2 weeks in a shelter is not the answer. We need to see the churches and the suburbs get involved. Because we're in the process of creating an underclass of young people who will live and die in this country and never in their life have jobs. It's not because they're lazy or shiftless. They can't read and write. They have no job skills. 23 million Americans. Many younger people cannot read and write. And the church, which has tremendous concern for education, as witnessed by Lutheran colleges and day schools, does almost nothing in terms of working with the poor. We need a whole new, people moving into education, we need some whole new urban solutions in terms of working with the poor. And addressing, if we don't, it's going to be a tremendous, tremendous number of young people are going to suffer. We're experiencing generational revolution. In my book, the book I'm working on, Wild Hope, I talk about my generation as the boosters, the boomers, and the busters. And the busters are a generation you need to be concerned about. They're the people that are under 25, and some of them are here tonight. They're less informed internationally than any population I've ever worked with. They read less than any population. They don't know geographically where they are in the world. Out of all the industrialized nations, 17 to 25-year-old Americans came in dead last in terms of knowing where they were geographically. In taking tests, some of them put Africa in Canada, in the Soviet Union, in the Isthmus of Panama, and they weren't joking around. We need to equip and prepare the young to be world Christians and start to be prepared to live in an increasingly international world. And I don't know how we do that, because the family is changing too. And part of the reason that the busters are having such a hard time is that many more of them are coming from abusive, fragmented, and addictive home backgrounds. They are not getting the nurturing necessary, so they come into the church. Steve Hainer, who's president of Youth for Christ, InterVarsity, that works on college campuses, said, we just can't get the young people out involved in serving others because they come to our campuses so broken and so much struggling with their own backgrounds of abuse and fragmentation that we really have to spend a lot of time with that first. So if we hope to have those young people be a part of God's answer in the future, we're going to have to start working with them. Because we're going to see a changing family, we're going to see more step-parent families, and the church doesn't know how to work with step-parent, single-parent families. We don't have churches that are reaching out very effectively to anybody much other than the nuclear family, so we need some whole new ministry designs. Whole range of new ethical issues. Euthanasia is going to be one of the issues that we're going to see coming along. A lot of issues in terms of genetics. The Congress has voted to spend a huge amount of money to actually do a global map of the whole human genetic profile. Initially, this is done to correct genetic defects, but there are people, of course, who already want to use this information to build a better baby and build a better human being, to start moving into that whole area of the redesign of the human species. So there are a whole range of new ethical issues, and somehow we need to be more aware and more informed of those. Neighborhood revolution, singles, marrieds. One of the things that's going to happen with the peace dividend is that it's not going to go as far as we thought. I don't think we're going to see a war on poverty program reappear, but we need to start reprioritizing and trying to use that resource at a neighborhood level. People are starting to take initiatives at neighborhood levels and the churches at neighborhood levels, but so often what I see, instead of the churches getting hands-on involved, they pay some ecumenical group to do it for them. Somehow we need to connect the church with taking time, every member, in active witness and service in their own communities. Well, what I've tried to sketch here, just very briefly, and we're going to break down to small discussion groups in just a second, is a future in which the challenges are increasing dramatically, internationally and within the United States. Those of you who are in decision time, all of these challenges represent opportunities, maybe for all of us in the room as we think about our own lives and future. The purpose in going through this is not to overwhelm us, but to start to help us realize that if we're to be the people of God in a world that's changing, we need to anticipate what the new challenges are, and then ask creatively, not how we can respond to all of these, but where can we grasp the problems at the near edge? How can we, with the gifts that God has given us, engage something of that? Well, my sense in terms of the Christian response, very simply, is that the governments of the world are not going to do more in terms of what we're moving into is a future where the challenges are really falling over one another at a tremendous clip. The governments are not going to do more. The Western European governments give a much greater percentage of their GNP, as Bread for the World knows, to third world development assistance than the United States does. But to jumpstart the economies of Eastern Europe, they're going to take money out of third world development giving and invest in that. Canada has already cut back in their development aid. The United States is not going to do more. We're going to do less because of our huge budgetary deficit. What we do give is going to go to try to put Panama and Nicaragua back together and, of course, continue to support Israel. And so we're not going to see our government do more. The third world governments, because of the debt crisis, are not going to do more. Mainline churches, I have to tell you honestly, I get so discouraged when I work with your execs of mainline denominations. And I haven't been with Lutherans lately, but I've been with Presbyterians and others. And I point out, I don't know how many of you read Ruffin McKinney's book, Mainline Religion, but you need to. You need to read Fragmented Gods by Reginald Bibby, which is a Canadian. I'll give a bibliography Monday night. I'll give you a bibliography. But these books essentially tell the same story. In 1946, two out of three people were found in church Sunday morning in Canada. Today, it's one in three. They are following the post-Christian era that we see in Western Europe. The mainline churches in this country are declining at a very rapid clip and graying. And Ruffin McKinney says the reason that you're declining and graying is, first of all, you didn't have as many kids as the Catholics did and conservative Protestants. And those that you did have, you didn't keep. Most of your kids do not stay in your churches, and they're not being lost to conservative Protestantism. They're being lost to full-blown secularism. And so you don't have young people coming up. And mainline denominations within the next 10 years are going to be facing tremendous debt economic crisis. Because your money is all in that senior population that is disappearing from the scene. And when they disappear, the boomers are not giving at the same rate, particularly the younger boomers and the baby bus generation. The giving stats are already in. People under 25 in many organizations are giving fully 50% less. So as the younger boomers and the baby bus generation come through the pipeline, there will not be the economic support for concerns about integrity of creation, peace, justice, South Africa, hunger in the United States, or any of the other issues you care about, because we have not successfully nurtured and brought along the children of the next generation. We need to get some of the dear people who are near retirement, give them early retirement in our major denominations, and bring some of the young women and men out of the seminaries and move them into leadership. Some people are still into risk-taking, because I don't find that the leadership in ecumenical churches are open to taking the risks and really making the commitment to the kind of growth that must take place if we're going to begin to address the challenges of the 80s, 90s, and into the 21st century. Well, let me stop right there. And in small groups, groups of three, what are the most compelling issues that may be something that I didn't even mention? There are many things that I've left out. What are the most compelling issues that concern you most that for you maybe you might connect with as a point of opportunity in your own life? What are the implications in your life and in your church, in your denomination for the things we're talking about? What are the implications for both the needs and challenges and the inability of the church to respond? And I should just say, on the evangelical side of the street, that's where the churches are growing, but those people, by and large, are not concerned about justice and peace and environmental issues. Their concerns are much more private, and they're not going to begin to address the issues. Well, let's find two other people, talk about what you feel are some of the most urgent concerns that we need to think about in our lives and our churches, and number two, what are the implications as we think about our mission and the decisions we're making for our own future? Find two other people, let's talk.
To counteract the kind of gloom that this sometimes puts over an audience, Monday night we're talking about hope. We're talking about the hope and purposes of God, and how we can create more festive, creative, celebrative lives than anything the rat race offers, but lives where we have some time and resources for somebody else. We're going to talk about that Monday night, and then in my other two sessions, we're going to put you to work doing creativity work. We're going to get sheets of paper, and we're going to have you create alternatives for your own lives. Single people, married people, lifestyle possibilities, new job possibilities. We're going to put you to work brainstorming, coming up with new ideas and sharing them. So the last two sessions, I'm not going to talk, you're going to work. You're going to create, in the final session, you'll share those. And then we'll talk about how we connect those back home where we live. Because so often we come to a session like this and we don't know how to build the bridges back home. We're going to try to talk about building bridges back home. So Monday night we talk about the creative and God's purposes, and then it's where am I? Wednesday morning. Wednesday morning. Move the screen so you can see. At 10:30, we start the creativity process, and right here, and then we complete it right here on Friday morning at 11:40. So that's what we're going to be doing. And if you want to follow up, they told me to mention about the books. Some of my books came in. The Mustard Seed Conspiracy is 10 years old, but for people who want to get into more of the substance, that still gets into more of the substance, even though it's a bit dated. We're talking about environmental issues back there and a lot of the other issues. And regrettably, a lot of the stuff has come to pass. The newer book, Why Settle for More and Miss the Best, is written for younger people. It's written for people who are in the life decision years, singles and others. I try to write a very clear, direct, popular book about how we connect our lives to God's purposes with lots of examples in the last chapters on creativity, and those in the bookstores. Now, let's share, and I'll have a much longer bibliography Monday night. Let's share. What are some of the issues, some of the things you were talking about in your group, some of the connections it made with your life or your church? Let's just have a conversation here. One at a time, please.
I brought up about, I've been reading for some years about we are at the point where the entire world is going to have a major problem with potable water, mm-hmm. which has a direct relationship to the population.
Yes.
Because of what we need for life.
Right.
And this is going to face all of us.
It's going to be increasingly throughout the world. Water is an issue, of course, right now, and you write Bread for the World, and they can give you information about potable water in other parts of the world. But even the United States, we're going to see a lot of regional battles. People in California are going to want to drain off the water from Colorado and Oregon. So we're going to see some real problems and growing problems with drinking water in our societies that are in our cities that is not safe. It's polluted. So water is going to become a growing issue. That's right. What else? Other discussions, conversations? Yes.
I was in a group with three teachers, and mm-hmm. they all agreed that they're seeing in their kids a lack of support, a lack of nurturance from the nuclear family.
Right.
The family just isn't there the way mm-hmm. it was.
That's right.
Say a generation or two ago. And
so what do we do with that?
Well, no real solutions came up except, I guess, some idea that something has got to nurture our kids.
Does anybody have any idea what that something should be?
Well, right now they're having the schools become parents.
Yeah.
We're teaching the social skills.
A lot of surrogate parenthood there, sure. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the answer. I think the church needs to become family again. And that's hard because ecumenical people, apart from Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. and a few other places I can mention, really don't take community seriously. I've not been able to stir ecumenical people. They can get together one evening a week for a committee meeting, but to get together and just share their lives and be supportive is, hey, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm okay. And they're not open for that. And somehow we need something, I think, like Church of the Savior, where we're much more involved in one another's lives. So you have nuclear families, single parent families, singles, divorced together, being really family together. I think we need some new models.
Working towards church unity.
It does, and it also means people who are committed to that. That's what
I happen to belong to University Presbyterian Church in mm-hmm. Seattle, mm-hmm. which is deeply and profoundly committed to all of the issues that you raise as well as we can. And I know many people whose lives have been ripped apart by various tragedies who have found community and family.
Yes, yes, they have.
In our church, but a large reason for the success of the growth, I think, in our church is that we are committed not only to knitting together people whose mm-hmm. lives are ripped apart, but to finding a place for them to find a mission
exactly
out in the community or and in the world somewhere. And
exactly.
That's what puts us together, is finding a purpose for us.
And having gone to Youth Press myself for 6 years, I affirm that that is happening very strongly. I was in a small group in that church. But the origins of that spirit of community comes, I think, more out of their evangelical impulses than the other impulses. But that's, there are churches that are exceptions, and I'm not saying there aren't. There are churches. It's just so many of the churches I work with, people see each other Sunday morning, and that's about it.
I wonder, too, about how much of our church's response is influenced by what is the image of God that we have had mm-hmm. in the churches for the past however many years.
Okay.
They have been supportive of the kind of lifestyle we wanted to live, and, mm-hmm. and the people in power have of our churches have developed images of God that have been promoted to the neglect of many others.
I think you're right. Images of God, and I think images of the better future, which I'm going to talk about Monday night. I think that all of us, of all of our religious traditions, have very uncritically embraced modernization and the American dream as an unquestioned given. And for all of our talk about the lordship of God in our lives, getting the career underway comes first, getting the house in the burbs comes first, getting upscale lifestyle comes first, and then with whatever's left over. And there isn't much left over, and more importantly, that those visions of a better future are profoundly shaping of our fundamental values. And we just need to get back to talking about Scripture changing fundamental values. And I'm not finding that conversation going on very much any place. And so we'll talk about that a little more Monday.
The Scripture emphasis is an important one.
Yes.
From my point of view, I mean, I can immediately think from my knowledge of the Old Testament what you're saying about the whole of our life mm-hmm. belongs to God. And Jesus says, if you don't hate mother, father, brother, sister, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. more than me, can't be my disciple, or words to that mm-hmm. effect. And I do think we don't listen to those words or take them seriously. And that I would be interested personally in hearing during this time, this week, of making some real connections between what the Scripture says and what you're talking about.
I'll give you an outline of Scripture out of Isaiah and Luke that has specifically addressed this, because I think we need to develop a new critique of the influence of culture in our lives, and then the call to a much more radical kind of discipleship, whole life stewardship, where it isn't, where we don't take the Western dream and modernization as an unquestioned given and then do our religion around the edges of it, but where we really place the following of Christ at the center of our lives, and all of our other life decisions emanate out from that. Every one of us. Well, let me just give you an example. Church of the Savior, to become a member of that church. I'm not suggesting this for every church present, but it ups the ante a little bit and starts to look more like what I read about in the gospel. To be a member there, they expect you to be in church every week, just like Rotary. They expect you to be in a small group every week so that we're part of a nurturing community where we're also equipped for mission. They expect every member to be involved in mission every week, and I don't think that's unrealistic. I think we can even create ministries for children to be involved with parents in ministry every week. Very few churches have more than 20% of the people involved in actual service.